This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purzel. Coming up this morning, you'll hear about the Civic Garden Center's new Green Learning Station. And in about 15 minutes, Bruce Weber shares stories from his book, As They See Him, A Fan's Travels in the Land of Umpires. But to begin with, Jay Hanselman has a look at what was making local news headlines this week.
Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels has hired an outside firm to investigate the Indiana State Fair concert stage collapse that killed 5 people and injured more than 40 others. That came after questions were raised about how objective the state could be in essentially policing itself. Daniels' office said Thursday he contacted James Lee Witt, a former director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to hire Witt Associates to conduct a comprehensive independent analysis of the state fair's preparedness and response to the collapse. Witt's company will provide a report to Daniels and his fair commission on state fair procedures and how decisions were made. Attention has centered on how fair officials reacted to worsening weather conditions before a wind gust brought the stage down onto the crowd Saturday. The groundbreaking isn't set yet, but green and white streetcar signs are now up in downtown Cincinnati. The temporary signs indicate future stops and show the system route. City Manager Milton Dahoney says the streetcar won't solve all the city's economic woes, but it will play a key role.
Along with new corporate headquarters like First Financial, putting people to work on the casino project, bringing the banks to life, and investing in our housing, transportation like streetcar will be a factor in our growth.
Meanwhile, opponents gathered enough signatures to put an anti-streetcar measure on the November ballot. Former Mayor Tom Lucan calls the streetcar a white elephant and likens it to another city project.
When they built the Riverfront Transit Center, they said 50,000 kids every month are going to use it, and not one kid has used it. It is padlocked today.
The temporary signs cost $2,900 and were paid for with streetcar funds. A study committee could soon be in place to look for ways to make Columbia Parkway in Cincinnati a safer route. It follows a serious crash early Tuesday morning that left a city police sergeant who was on his way to work in critical condition. Councilmember Leslie Gibbs says the city needs to work to make sure the parkway doesn't turn into a NASCAR race.
Given the fact that it's supposed to be a parkway, the speed limit is 45, it's not 60, but the fact that there are 3 lanes going into downtown, people treat it like a freeway. So we want it, you know, in the 6 years I've been on council, we've never had a study to look at it, and we need to figure out what to do and change it in very short order.
The task force would include several city departments, including traffic and engineering, police, fire, and parks. Giz and council members Bortz, Murray, and Lippert held a press conference Thursday morning along Columbia Parkway to highlight the problems. The group says it wants a report with recommendations by January 1st. There's good news for Cincinnati Public Schools. The district earned an effective rating on its state report card for the second straight year. CPS says it's the highest-rated large urban school district in the state and the only one to earn an effective rating. Superintendent Mary Ronan says 82% of CPS schools are rated in continuous improvement or higher.
2 years ago, there were 30 schools in either academic emergency or academic watch. Now, there's still 10 schools in those lowest two categories, so we still have work to do. But to go from 30 schools to 10 schools in 2 years, I think that is a great accomplishment.
Ronan says the goal for this school year is to take the results to the next level by focusing on new national standards. There was some backsliding. Based on last year's information, at least 7 schools slipped down a notch. 3 years ago, Kentucky began requiring all public high school juniors to take the ACT exam. It measures college readiness in English, reading, math, and science. Now the state's education commissioner is hoping the test will replace No Child Left Behind as a way to determine school accountability. Terry Holliday says the current system is flawed.
No Child Left Behind data is going to come out in the next few weeks, and it's going to say 95% of our districts are failing, and that's absolutely wrong. While proficiency in math and reading is important, and we want to keep that, what we really need to turn our focus on is, are we getting every high school graduate ready for the next step, which is college and career?
Holliday says he would like to see a combination of the ACT and a job skills assessment. ACT data for the 2011 graduating class were released this week, showing an average composite score of 19.2 for public school students in Kentucky. A perfect score is a 36. More than 60 law enforcement officials joined together this week to kick off the Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign. During a press conference at Newport-on-the-Levee, Cincinnati Police Captain Dan Girard said driving under the influence is an issue to be taken seriously.
A person under the influence of alcohol and or drugs is responsible for a fatal accident in the United States once every 45 minutes, every single day.
From now through Labor Day, Tri-State police officers will increase their presence around the clock in an effort to keep impaired drivers off the road. That's the Week in Review. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Jay Hanselman.
Cincinnati Edition for a Saturday morning, where it's time to go on the money with Chris DeSimeo.
Volatility continued on Wall Street last week. A giant rally early in the week gave way to some world-class jitters by midweek. Inflation figures and retail sales earnings actually coming in much better than expected. However, first-time claims for unemployment insurance on Thursday a little stronger than had been hoped for, and the Philly Fed index actually was significantly lower than expected. That, coupled with some downgrades of the future growth of the United States economy by major Wall Street firms both Thursday and Friday, sent stocks on a pretty wild ride. They were down over 400 points on Thursday. They were bracing for a much lower opening yesterday, but by the time the clock struck 10:15, they were actually in positive territory. So the volatility has certainly not disappeared. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show our friend David Osborne, who is a managing director at the firm of Osborne, Ross, Williams, and Donahoe in Cincinnati, Ohio. David has been in this business. Now, this is his 30th year managing money. David is a chartered financial analyst. And thanks again, David, for taking part of your weekend to be with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
This volatility in your 29 plus, well, this is your 30th year. Have you seen anything like this? Or I guess better yet, what does this remind you of?
Well, it really reminds me of 2008, unfortunately. To some degree, it reminds me of what was going on in 1987, but that was relatively compact and compressed back then compared to, I think, what we've been dealing with now for the last few years. You know, we had a lot of volatility to the upside in 2009, and after a period of actually lower volatility, this is just now coming back around over the last few months. And I think we really have a lot of mixed data right now. As you said, retail sales are strong, but other data really indicates a softness. And so I think investors have a choice of whether or not to look at the glass half full or half empty. And it depends on which day you look at it.
Yeah. And speaking of half empty and half full, you're really talking about the broad outlook for the American economy and the global economy. What is your firm's outlook as far as those two items, both domestic and global economies?
Well, I think that if we look at the global economy, growth rates have been ratcheted down by many analysts here. And I think that has been a result of some weak data that's come out just in the last month. I think it will be a mixed bag in the U.S. The consumer is actually doing okay right now. Consumer spending has been strong, which was reflected in retail sales. But business spending continues to be soft, and businesses are holding on to their cash. They're not spending it. I think there's a lot of fear and uncertainty right now. And depending on what happens in Europe, unfortunately, they are having problems over there. There is a concern that that could wash up on our own shores and affect our own economy.
What has to happen to break that that logjam, that bottleneck, in order for business spending to grow again? What kind of conditions should we as savers and investors be looking to see?
That's a great question. I think it's really two things, Chris. I think that certainly confidence needs to be better in the future, But demand needs to pick up also. It's not just a lack of confidence right now. Demand is very sluggish, and I think if we start seeing a pickup in demand, which is cyclical and will come back at some point, I think companies will be likely to loosen up the purse strings. But in terms of confidence, unfortunately right now, I think there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty about U.S. government policy. We've heard it in the media, very critical comments about all sides of the aisle, really, both sides, the fact that they really had difficulty coming up with a long-term answer to our debt reduction plan. I think that sent a little bit of a shockwave around the global markets. But I think that right now, I think we do need policy change. I think we need to have policies that result in job creation because we're still struggling with over 9% unemployment.
The Japanese earthquake, which seems like a lifetime ago now, was just 5 months ago. The effects of that have finally started to fade, and there are reports, not only anecdotally, but actually numbers showing up in the government data that talk about auto production and factories ramping up again. So if the effects of that earthquake are finally beginning to fade, how long would this rebound in production at the auto industry be felt, and how big of an impact could it have?
Well, I think it can have a significant impact. There was a tremendous supply chain disruption from the earthquake, and many economists have felt that that would begin to moderate in the second half of the year and actually be one of the catalysts for a modest economic recovery in the second half of the year. Unfortunately, I think with data that we've received in the last month, despite a pickup in Japan and the easing of supply chain disruption, I think that there's enough concern, again, the glass half empty, that actually could affect our outlook here for the second half. And I think there's one thing that's very important to remember, Chris, and that's that, you know, typically when there's a lot of fear and uncertainty, it does create opportunities for longer-term investors. And, you know, unfortunately, we do live in a very short-term-oriented society now where many of the financial media is geared towards trading and not long-term investing. And I think if an investor has an outlook for 3 to 5 years, a lot of this uncertainty has created very low valuations in the market. Corporate earnings, as you know, have been extremely strong this year and are expected to do pretty well next year also, albeit they are slowing a bit. But I think, you know, if we look at low valuations, lots of fear. And the third thing really is tremendous liquidity. There is so much money out there, not only on the balance sheets of corporations, but investors are sitting on a lot of cash right now.
Trillions. I mean, just the money market funds over, what, $2 trillion?
Over $2 trillion and about that same amount at on corporate balance sheets. And, you know, I heard a respected economist recently make a point that, you know, he said bull markets start when you have the confluence of three factors. You have very high fear and pessimism, first of all. Secondly, you have lots of liquidity, lots of money around. And third, very low valuations. And we have that right now. So we're in a bottoming process, in our opinion. It sometimes can be messy and can take a while. But I think for long-term investors, there are great opportunities that are emerging here.
Yeah. In your newsletter, which is available at your recently revamped website. There'll be a link to your website from the WVXU.org website. There are lots of nice little nuggets in your latest newsletter. And you describe in your second quarter 2011 newsletter about dividend growth as having risen, actually. So the rate of dividend growth was higher in the first half of this year. What are you looking for dividend growth, I guess, next year? This mm-hmm. second half of the year is not typically when you see dividend hikes. Is that
right? Well, I think dividends have been on the increase. I think if the financials can start raising dividends, then I think as an average on the S&P 500, we're going to see very good dividend growth. But the financial stocks, the banks, some of the insurance companies, they really haven't stepped up and increased dividends yet. And I think there's still a great deal of uncertainty around some of the financial regulation that's being proposed. And banks in particular are being very conservative raising dividends now. But we're hopeful that down the road we do start to see some increases coming in. But I think it's important to remember that dividends have accounted for about 45% of the return from the S&P 500 since 1928. In the decade of the 70s, they were actually close to 80% of the return. And to contrast that, in the decade of the 90s, they were only about 19% of the return. So we had as everybody may remember, we had a tremendous increase in asset values in the 1990s. And again, most of that return came from appreciation. But over the long term, it needs to be remembered that dividends account for a major part of return. And to ignore them, I think, would be a mistake. So.
Especially when you compare dividends to yields available on competing instruments, such as the government. I mean, just start with the theoretically risk-free investment, namely a government bond.
That's right.
The yield on the 10-year Treasury actually was now playing around at the 2% mark, and there are fairly influential, at least certainly well-known analysts and talking head types saying we could get to the one and a half on the 10-year. What would have to happen for interest rates in the government bond market to begin turning around and heading higher? What would have to happen?
Well, I think that a couple of things are going on. One of the reasons why the rate has dropped down so far is because investors have been piling into U.S. Treasuries as a safe haven. And that's the same reason why gold has been rallying here. It's a place to hide when times get really tough. Our feeling is that if we start to see better economic news down the road and confidence returning, that we are going to see a sell-off in treasuries as investors return to equities. And if that happens, that's naturally going to cause interest rates to rise. But I think there's another thing to really keep in mind. With all of the stimulus that has been pumped into the economy in the last few years, historically, this is inflationary. And right now, we have some signs that inflation is actually starting to pick up.
Sure. The consumer price inflation number and the producer price inflation figures released this week were actually pretty robust.
That's right. That's right. And I think that it is likely that at the current level, U.S. Treasuries are somewhat vulnerable to selling, again, once confidence begins to return to the market.
So don't turn your back on the dividends. Don't fall in love with the treasuries. Do your homework and be not afraid.
Well, I think there is merit in saying that, Chris. Especially if you look at the higher quality dividend payers now, from a valuation standpoint, we're as low as we've been in 20 to 30 years in many companies on a price-to-earnings multiple and then price-to-book also. It's just incredible to find a great company like Procter & Gamble with a 3.5% dividend yield at a time when a 10-year U.S. Treasury actually the other day ticked under 2%.
Yeah.
And Procter raises their dividend 9 to 10% a year.
Yeah. There'll be more information on that at your website.
That's correct.
David Osborne from the firm of Osborne, Ross, Williams, and Donahoe. I want to thank you so much for being with us this Saturday morning.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Chris DeSimeo on The Money.
This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. When you go to a baseball game, fans and players alike keep a close eye on the decisions made by four men on the field who are calling the balls, strikes, and outs. Being an umpire is not a job for the faint of heart. That's what New York Times reporter Bruce Weber found out as he wrote his new book, As They See Him, A Fan's Travels in the Land of Umpires. He spoke with Mark Haney.
Good morning, Bruce, and thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, really.
What prompted you to take this journey into the land of umpires?
Well, I have to blame it all on an editor I had at the New York Times, who sent me to write a feature story about umpire school, which just seemed like a lark to me, a nice lighthearted feature. And I went down to the Jim Evans Academy of Professional Umpiring in Kissimmee, Florida, spent a couple days, and what I saw there was so surprising to me as a baseball fan of 40 years that I thought, gee, you know, if this is surprising to me, I thought it would be surprising to a lot of other people as well.
Did you actually get to try your hand at umpiring once you were through school? Did you get to go out with some of the minor league umpires and actually try a game?
Well, I did a lot of amateur umpiring, you know, from Little League up through high school and an adult community league. So I didn't actually get in a professional minor league game, but I at one point for the book, during major league spring training, I went out on the field with the big leaguers in intra-squad games. So I worked a game with the Los Angeles Angels, and then I worked behind the plate in an intra-squad game with the San Francisco Giants. So I did get an experience of what it was like to watch major league pitching from up close that way.
And this isn't as easy as it looks, is it?
Well, it's terrifying, for one thing. And no, it isn't easy. I mean, certainly there are a lot of things about it that are difficult, you know, starting with just knowing what all the rules of the game are. But just being able to be, when you're on the bases, to be in the proper position to give yourself the best look at a play, and behind the plate to be able to follow pitches that are moving 90 or 95 miles an hour and breaking balls that are diving in every possible which way as though there was a little man in the ball driving it, you know. It's a difficult thing to do, and it takes a lot of training and a lot of experience to do it well.
Well, when you were working with the professionals, did you get any kind of funny looks or any ridicule or any teasing about the job you were doing?
Yes. I don't think they knew I was an amateur, but there was after all preseason, so the stakes were not at the height that they would be during the season. But, you make a close call, and a hitter is a hitter. He looks back at you and raises his eyebrow goes, what? Or, you know, that kind of stuff. There was one call that I knew was egregiously bad. I just got fooled on a breaking pitch the same way a hitter would be fooled on it, and I called it too soon, and I thought it was going to be a ball, and it broke in, and it was a strike. No, it was the other way around. I thought it was going to be a strike, and it turned out to be a ball, but I called it a strike. Unfortunately, the hitter at the time was the catcher on the other team, so
uh-oh,
he was grumbling at me for the next two innings about that.
Well, speaking of abuse, where did the universal favorite abuse of all sports fans, the one they really like to yell about, kill the umpire,
mm-hmm,
where did that come from?
For the earliest citation I could find was in Casey at the Bat. Yeah, you remember the old poem?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first citation of it. There had been somebody from the Hall of Fame, a historian from the Hall of Fame, found a reference to killing the umpire, that fans had threatened to kill the umpire or something, in a Cincinnati newspaper a few years earlier. But the actual phrase, kill the umpire, dates to I think the date is 1888, but I could be misquoting my own book. Certainly, late 19th century.
Is there a dominant character trait in people who go into umpiring? I would imagine being pretty thick-skinned is one trait you would have to have.
Right. I mean, it's that I think people who go into umpiring don't all have that trait. People who survive in it do. The guys who have experience in the minor leagues and the guys who are in the major leagues certainly have learned to accept that their workplace is a hostile, you know, is a hostile environment, and they get pretty used to the insults. I've had many guys tell me that they stopped hearing what fans say, a long time ago, unless they hear somebody say something they haven't heard before, which almost never happens. It turns out that fans are monumentally unimaginative when it comes to yelling abuse at the umpire. You know, it's pretty much, you stink, and poke a hole in the mask, and you're blind, you bum, and that's pretty much the size of it.
Keep it simple and basic. The simpler,
yeah,
the better, right? I imagine the one thing that they're striving to do is not to become a part of the game. In other words, not to interfere, not to stand out in any way.
I think that's reasonably true. There are moments when all of them will tell you that they have to stand out and that they have to become a part of the game, as it were. I mean, if there is going to be a brawl, for example, it's up to the umpire to get in between the players and make sure that brawl, or at least do everything they can to make sure the brawl doesn't happen. But, yeah, I mean, one of the things that umpires will tell you is the high point of their day is the third out in the ninth inning. Getting to the end of the game without having something screwy happen means to them that they've done a good job, and it's really what their objective is when the game starts, is to get through the game without incident.
How are women faring in umpiring?
Oh. Well, terribly. At the moment, there are none in professional umpiring. There have been six women who have tried their hand at professional umpiring, six who have made it, at least worked a season or a game in the minor leagues. Only one made it to as high as AAA, and that was a woman named Pam Postuma. The last woman to work in the minor leagues was someone named Rhea Cortizio, who was finally fired at the end of 2007 and judged wanting as an umpire, although there is some dispute over whether or not she was good enough to advance to AAA. I spent a fair amount of time with Rhea, and she had a terrible, terrible time being ostracized by her fellow umpires more than anybody else.
Why do you think that is? Is it a good old boys network? Is that what they're facing?
You know, it's a bit of a difficult question, but the short answer is yes, that umpires are a very tight-knit bunch, and they like to be around people who are, you know, sharing the precise same experience. And, you know, men seem to have a difficult time taking that approach when there's a woman involved. I watched Rhea umpire a number of games, and I thought she did fine. I mean, I'm not an expert at judging umpires, but I got to be pretty good at it. But other umpires tell me, you know, she just wasn't that good. And, you know, guys that I liked and respected said, you know, the reason she didn't make it was because she didn't do this right or she didn't do that right. At the same time, I saw an awful lot of evidence that they were just scornful of her because she, you know, wasn't one of them. So it's a difficult call.
Baseball started to make limited use of instant replay.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's something that's going to become more widespread in the game?
Well, if the owners have their way, I think it will. I hope that it doesn't. I mean, I personally love the role that umpires play in the game. I think that they make the game more complicated and more interesting and more human and much more fun to watch. The powers that be that run baseball, they resent the umpire's authority on the field, I think is the best way of putting it. Every year at the general manager's meetings, there is complaint about the umpire's attitude and the power that they hold on the field. And it's my belief that the owners, if they could, would find a way to run the games electronically, which I think would be a terrible mistake. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to happen or that even they could find a way to do it. I just think that sort of expresses the attitude of the people who run the game. There's no more illuminating fact in this regard than I can think of than the fact that Major League Baseball plays virtually no role, none, in the recruitment, the training and the supervising and the development of the umpires who end up on a big league field.
Now, integrity's got to be a key concern of umpires. Has the referee corruption scandal that occurred in the NBA, has that had any effect on baseball?
It has, although as a sort of defense mechanism. I mean, the umpires have a fantastic record for integrity. You know, I certainly am not going to go to bat for each and every umpire as a moral paragon. But on the field, they have a terrific record. There has been only one incident in 133 years of professional baseball in which an umpire was accused of being in league with gamblers or of any sort of corruption involving being on the field, and that was a man named Richard Higham, and it took place in 1882. And the charges may very well have been spurious besides. So their record for honesty and integrity is better than any other constituency in the game.
What surprised you most about this journey you took into the land of the umpires?
I think how complicated the job is. I mean, every time I turned around, there was something I just didn't know about baseball that, you know, you hate to use the term inside baseball in this particular context, but I felt like I had somehow burrowed into the belly of the game in a way that was just completely impossible as a fan. I mean, the umpire's eye view, not only of the game as it's played on the field, but the game as it is presented to the country, is a completely different one than anyone suspects, and 99.9% of the fans ever get to see.
Well, Bruce, thank you for talking to us.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I appreciate the time.
Bruce Weber is author of As They See 'Em, A Fan's Travels in the Land of Umpires. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Mark Haney.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU and 88.5 WMUB. I'm Mark Purcell. Good morning. In the studio with me today is the program manager for the Green Learning Station at the Civic Garden Center of Greater Cincinnati. The Green Learning Station, a new facility that is opening up and having its ribbon-cutting ceremony this morning between 9 and 11. And here to talk about it is Ryan Mooney Bullock, the program manager of the Green Learning Station. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning, Mark.
For those who are not familiar with our little oasis of gardening here in Cincinnati, let's introduce folks to the Civic Garden Center.
Sure. The Civic Garden Center is a nonprofit organization that sits on about 8 acres of gorgeous gardens in the middle of the city. We're located on Reading Road, just north of William Howard Taft, so you've probably driven right by it and never even known it was there. We are over almost 70 years old now. We've been around since 1942. And our mission is building community through gardening, education, and environmental stewardship.
I know folks have heard about plant sales and the like at the Garden Center, but what else usually is happening there in that little oasis?
We've got a lot going on all the time. We teach classes for adults. We have field trips on our site for younger students called Compost Kids. We're out in schools and daycare centers and children's gardens all year round doing youth programming. And we also facilitate the city's community gardens program, which has over 40 gardens where people can come and rent a plot for the year and grow whatever they want to grow.
Now, how did the Garden Center get its start back in 1942?
Well, it was actually formed out of an interest in urban vegetable gardens, kind of as World War II was coming along and victory gardens were popping up. There weren't many resources for people to learn how to grow successfully. So the Civic Garden Center was founded as a resource for people to learn what they needed to learn about gardening in the city.
So 8 acres of garden, where did that land come from there at the corner of Reading and William Howard Taft?
Well, a old Cincinnati brewer, Cornelius Houck, assembled this property. He lived in a little arts and crafts house on the grounds, and as buildings came up for sale on Reading Road, he would buy them and tear them down and turn them into park space. So he was an avid gardener and actually planted over 900 varieties of shrubs and trees on the grounds, and really kind of pioneered this art of horticulture in this region. There wasn't a whole lot of focus on that until that time.
Well, the Green Learning Station is something that has been in the works for a couple of years and is coming to fruition now. And this is, if I'm not mistaken, an old Sohio gas station that has been altered. So what is the Green Learning Station?
The Green Learning Station is a place for people to come and learn how to use their properties to benefit the environment and also keep themselves healthy. So we have demonstrations of green stormwater management practices to show people how you can catch stormwater where it falls instead of letting it run off into our combined sewer system and create water pollution problems down the road. We also demonstrate effective composting methods and how you can grow plants anywhere and everywhere. So on the roof, on your balcony, in your yard, on your parking lot. We're really just trying to encourage especially urban dwellers to think creatively about how they can green up wherever they live or work.
So this this old Sohio gas station, this was adjacent to the Civic Garden property and what closed a number of years ago. And then the movement was made to create this Green Learning Station. How much conversion needed to be there? I know with old gas station sites, there's always worries about the old gas tanks and stuff like that. What kind of work needed to be done to create it?
Well, when we bought the property in 1987, the gas tanks had already been removed. So that was nice. We didn't have to mess with that part of it. We used the building for storage for our neighborhood gardens program and it's a parking lot. And so when we decided to convert it into more of an educational space, we added a couple of additions onto the front. So the facade doesn't really look as much like a gas station anymore. And it gave us a little more space for storage in addition to some classroom space. But because of we have 6 different types of pervious paving in the parking lot, which all has big gravel beds underneath it. So there was a lot of excavation to, pull up all the asphalt and soil in order to put in these pervious paving and gravel beds.
So explain pervious painting, pervious paving to folks.
Sure. Pervious paving is pavement that lets water go through it. So you can use pavers that are made out of regular concrete or brick, but they're set so that there are gaps between the pavers, and those gaps are filled with gravel instead of sand. So there's lots of little air spaces between the gravel that water can move through. And typically you would have a big gravel bed underneath your pervious paving, so the water can collect there until it has time to sink down into the ground below. Now, because we are on a gas station site, we didn't really want to let that happen in case there were potentially contaminated soils underneath it. So we ended up basically making these giant bathtubs under each of the paving areas, which allows us to collect a lot of data about how the water is moving through these systems. So we actually have a very sophisticated sensor network running throughout all these pavements, as well as our green roofs and our rain gardens, so we can see how these systems are performing over time and really contribute to the public database on green infrastructure systems.
And this was the part of the mission for the Green Learning Center, correct?
It was gathering
this data and following it along. What else are you looking at? You mentioned the green mm-hmm. roof. Is that something else you're monitoring?
Yeah, we have four different types of green roof systems. And so we're looking at moisture levels, how quickly they dry out, how much water they basically hold before we start seeing runoff coming off of them. We're looking at the water quality coming off of green roof sections versus regular roof sections. And I should say we're partnering with a number of professors and students at UC and are open to other partnerships as well to really do the research side of things.
So what will a visitor to the Green Learning Station be able to take away? I mean, how will they be able to see these pervious paving examples and green roofs in effect? What are you offering to a visitor?
Yeah. So if you come to the Green Learning Station, it's kind of like an urban nature center. So if you're used to going places where you might walk around a little bit and then see a sign and stop to read about a tree or something like that, it's similar to that, except in an urban environment. So there's lots of signage that explains what the different things are that are surrounding you. So you can learn more about the different types of green infrastructure. You can learn more about how to compost effectively or specific strategies for growing in creative places. We also offer lots of classes and tours and hands-on workshops, and the schedule for those are on our website, which is greenlearningstation.org.
Now, there is a big ceremony, 9 to 11 this morning, that is the official ribbon cutting of the Green Learning Station. What kind of activities are happening this morning?
Yeah, this is going to be a really fun, family-friendly event. So we have activities for kids where they can explore compost and do some nature-based and environmentally friendly crafts. We have a cool green roof experiment station where they can make it rain on a bunch of different types of green roofs and see which one runs off first. We also have food. Coffee Emporium is going to be there with their blender bike so you can blend your own smoothies and get a workout at the same time. We are going to have information stations where people can talk to experts about all the different features of our site. So it'll be a great day to visit the Green Learning Station because there'll be tons of people on hand who really know their stuff and can explain all the details of what's going on there. There's also a speaker lineup starting at 9:30, just for half an hour. And we have a number of great folks coming. The director of the Metropolitan Sewer District, Tony Parrott, will be there. The EPA's director of the research laboratory, Sally Gutierrez, will be there, as will Councilmember Quinlivan, Senator Kearney, and one of our heroes, Jack Jose, the principal of Gamble Montessori High School, who was the first group to come through our field trip. So we're excited to have them all.
Well, I know that this is every evolving technology. What's in the future for the Green Learning Station? Will it continue to adapt as it goes along, or what are the plans?
Yeah, that's the hope. You know, we're really just getting our research off the ground now. And so a number of the data sets that we're working on are going to be collected over a period of 5 years or more. But the hope is that as new technologies come up or we find out about different systems that we could add demonstrations. We still have a whole section of roof that's not greenified, so we've got lots of potential to do different things. And of course, with our workshops, we'll kind of be constantly changing up strategies and projects that people can come and learn about.
Well, thank you for the opportunity and bringing all this knowledge to folks. I can't wait to pay a visit.
Great. Well, look forward to seeing you there.
Ryan Mooney Bullock, the program manager of the Green Learning Station at the Civic Garden Center of Greater Cincinnati. The ribbon cutting is taking place this morning between 9 and 11, and you can find out more about the nonprofit Horticultural Center by visiting our website, wvxu.org, and just find new ways to go green. I'm Mark Purzel, and this is Cincinnati Edition. There's a new blog that brings a female perspective to sports. It's called Dames on Games, and one of its primary writers, Dale Marie Ponce, is in the front row with Betsy Ross.
Well, if there's anything that most of us like to do from time to time, is talk about sports. And as we know, in the blogosphere, there is many types of blogs out there that have to do with sports. Well, this is a different type of blog that you may have seen on Cincinnati.com recently. It's called Dames on Games, and there are three contributors to Dames on Games. We have one of them here with us today, Dale Marie Ponce. Thanks for being with us in the front row.
Thank you for having me.
Dames on Games. Well, that kind of tells you exactly what you guys are blogging about.
It took us probably 6 weeks to come up with a name. That was the hardest part of it, was trying to come up with a name that wasn't too corny, but definitely gave you an impression of what we were doing.
Well, it says it all. So as I mentioned, there are three of you who kind of take turns blogging. First of all, where did the idea come from? And, you know, how did you really get started?
I actually was very lucky to have some friends that worked at the Enquirer and ended up meeting Nick Herm, who is my editor. And he has had a wish for a long time now of having a blog on Cincinnati.com that represented a female's perspective on sports. Got to meet him through friends, and he said, "Would you be interested in writing about sports and having people read it?" And I said, kind of, yeah. Ever since I was 10, yes, actually. So I sent him some of my writing samples. Kelly had done an internship with the Enquirer, so that's how he was able to get her on board.
Kelly
Napke, says. And then Emily Pointer is a recent addition. She is a student at Ohio State and runs her own blog. And Nick came across that and said, "Hey, would you want to contribute?" So that's how we came to be. And I'm sure there'll be guest writers as well to give us a break. But it's been an absolute blast. I've had so much fun with it. So,
because I think the secret to blogging, and it's one, I think, cardinal rule that a lot of people don't follow. Once you start blogging, you need to keep it up. I mean, it's not like once a month. You need to keep it up. And you three are very good about keeping it up and keeping it current. And I'm sure it helps because there are three of you and not just one person.
Right. I personally try to put something up every day, Monday through Thursday, Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. I do take the weekends off because I have a full-time regular job that I do. So, but yeah, it's definitely, I think that's been part of the success of it. We were actually the number 10 blog of Cincinnati.com blogs for June, and that was our first full month.
Awesome.
So out of the over 50 blogs, we did pretty well. So hopefully we keep that up.
That's great. So where did this love of sports come from?
I am from Detroit, And I was, let's see, 6 years old when the Detroit Tigers won the World Series in 84. And that started the love affair. My mom is a huge baseball fan. My dad would take me to the games, but really my mom is the number one sports fan I know. She usually knows more about what's going on with the Reds than I do. So it goes way back, and over the course of my life, I've added more and more sports, and actually did my college internship with the Cincinnati Reds. So always been having a hand in being very interested, but sports writing has definitely been my dream since I was 10. I used to write fake articles. So sweet Lou Whitaker gets his 2000th hit. So it's been definitely a dream come true, and definitely a blast.
Oh, that's great. We are talking with Dale Marie Ponce. She is one of the bloggers on Dames on Games, and you can read that blog at Cincinnati.com. So you have this platform now. What's been the reaction?
This is where it gets awkward for me because I hate reading the comments. So I'm very sensitive. So my editor, fortunately, does a little bit of interference because it's too new for me to be able to take all that criticism. But we definitely get a lot of comments. I wrote a top 10 hottest Reds post a while back that got more hits than anything else put together. I didn't really want to write it because that's not usually my concern, although there are very handsome Reds. But that got a lot of attention for us, and kind of the idea of balancing being a sports fan with being a female sports fan. So I'm not watching the game just for the handsome men, but I sure enjoy the handsome men. So I think that's been the toughest part, is that balance of being taken seriously as a sports fan and seeing the comments that are going to obviously respect me as a sports fan or kind of cast a cynical eye. So, but only time will tell if they continue to respect me as a sports fan.
Well, and I think you're right that there is a fine line. There is a balance that you have to really try to follow. Although I have noticed over the last few years that women in sports, writing, broadcasting, whatever, we are much more accepted now.
Oh, definitely. I agree that when I was a little girl, there weren't any.
Mm-hmm.
There were none. So to see that there's women on SportsCenter, on, you know, doing sports casting, doing reporting, is definitely, we've come a long way. Just in, you know, my 25 years of experience.
Yeah, that's very true. So where would you like to see this blog go? What would you like to do with it?
Well, it's very early, so I want to keep getting attention and keep getting readership. And, you know, I have interest in sports outside of Cincinnati sports. So if someday it was able to get, you know, some more attention from outside of Cincinnati, that'd be great, because then I would get to write about basketball and soccer and other things that aren't always to a Cincinnati audience. I've said that my dream is to write for ESPN, because I've been in the magazine and I've been on ESPN radio now. So I don't want to be on TV, but I would like to write for the people that say it on TV or the magazine. The magazine will work too. So mm-hmm. If ESPN needs anybody, give a call.
Contact you. And that brings up a good point, because I know recently there was, a bit of controversy, you could say, about Tiger Woods letting his longtime caddy go. And I know that was one of the topics that you touched on Dames on Games. And there was this whole thing about, you know, is that fair? Did they get too close? Was Tiger, being nasty? Was Steve, you know, whining when he shouldn't have been? I mean, it was a good discussion that I kept hearing on talk radio. But, I mean, you really brought out the points in the blog in that, you know, it's a business. But that's one thing that, you're right, it's very Reds, Bengals, UC Xavier-centric here. it doesn't hurt to educate us about some of the other things going on in sports.
And that's, fortunately, you know, I have free rein from my editor on what to write about. He is able to give me recommendations on what will garner the most interest. Mm-hmm. But it is nice to be able to give some feedback on things that I think are important in the sports world. From the business sense of it, I think that the NFL lockout had a lot of, I found it fascinating to the business side of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love football, but the back and forth I thought was great. I think that there was a lot to learn from players coming together to do a collective bargaining agreement, because there's a lot of discussion about unions and their powers. So I thought, why aren't people being interested? Why are people being angry? Cincinnati Bengals fans are angry because, you know, I paid for the stadium and I want to be able to watch my football. Well, you're going to watch football. Football's mm-hmm. going to come back. You're going to be fine. But why not look at this and say, this is amazing stuff we're talking about. We're going to be talking about this years from now. Remember when the lockout happened and how it got resolved. So I guess the one thing that I get as a female sports fan that is probably advantageous to me is the ability to separate the emotion. And it's funny that the men generally can't get their emotion out of it. So that's one of the parts I enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. And, I mean, let's face it, all sports is business anymore, period.
This is true. Pretty much everything is business anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we're gonna go through this with the NBA. We're going to go through this with baseball. So this is probably just the first chapter of our sports economics 101 lessons. So.
And we all need a lesson in economics.
Oh, don't we, though? Well, it's a fascinating blog. If you have not read it, please do so. It's on Cincinnati.com under the sports section of the blog section. It is called Dames on Games, Dale Marie Ponce. Thank you so much for being with us on the Front Row.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow morning on Cincinnati Edition, Amy Dehan from the Cincinnati Art Museum talks about the recently rediscovered treasure trove of musical instruments. Richard Louv discusses the benefits of getting back to nature and his new book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. And Thane Maynard's guest is Josh Knights, the executive director of the Nature Conservancy Ohio chapter. Those stories and more coming up on Cincinnati Edition tomorrow morning at 7 on 91.7 WVXU. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Bruce Ellis, with help from Kevin Rowinski and Rick Andres. Assistant producers are Kevin Reynolds and Catherine Gamble. And I'm the executive producer and host of Cincinnati Edition, Mark Purcell. Thanks for tuning to 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. It's 8 o'clock.